TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Katie Singer, The Internet's Footprint, Part 2 of 2. Current efforts by the industry to roll out 5G cellular networks across the U.S. heightened the interest in two recent TUC radio programs. There was British Prime Minister Boris Johnson warning us of the digital surveillance state. He said, "In the future, your mattress will monitor your nightmares. Your fridge will beep for more cheese." On the same TUC radio program, medical doctor Deborah Davis reported on tests commissioned by the Chicago Tribune in August 2019. Results showed that radio frequency radiation exposure from the most popular smartphones measured higher than the legal safety limit. The way most users carry smartphones on their bodies and hold them close to their head when they talk sends more radio frequency radiation into their bodies than they know. What this may mean for our children is addressed by Katie Singer in this talk. Katie Singer is the author of An Electronic Silent Spring, Facing the Dangers and Creating Safe Limits, and the forthcoming Our Web of Inconvenient Truths, The Internet, Energy Use, Toxic Waste, and Climate Change. How on earth do we shrink the Internet's footprint? Here's Katie Singer.
One of my favorite suggestions, but it is by no means easy. Every family is going to take this differently. But we need to delay children's use of electronics until they have mastered reading, writing, and math on paper. I know so many parents with the best of intentions who've been giving their children electronics since before they had speech and finding that their children really take to this stuff. We need to, as much as possible, balance their use of electronics with time outside in nature, on paper, with eye-to-eye contact. I can recommend a couple of websites. One is zonein.ca. There's also an MD child psychiatrist, Victoria Dunkley. She has a wonderful book called Reset Your Child's Brain, where she lays out a program for giving your child a 3-week electronic fast. And children have sometimes cleared up autism and even psychotic behavior from doing this fast. Then she suggests how you can reintroduce electronics gradually. Also interesting, in Shandong province in China, it's a very large province, 40% of their children now have myopia. And in November of 2018, they decided that children will not be allowed to bring cell phones to school, and no child will be allowed a computer session for longer than 15 minutes at a time, and no more than 1 hour total in a day. In terms of children, that certainly would reduce their EMR exposure to delay their use of electronics, but it also impacts the footprint, because the sooner that children become users, the sooner they become users and consumers of the energy it takes to run this stuff. So we all need to pressure manufacturers to make modular, repairable electronics. If you're a business or a school district and you buy 10,000 laptops or something, you've got purchase power and you can say, I'm only going to do this if there's a way to make sure that the device can be wired. I'm only going to buy this if it's repairable. You know, so if the screen breaks, then we can replace it. That would be modular electronics. And we need to pressure manufacturers to build this kind of equipment. Web designers, very important. We need to minimize videos, pop-ups, slideshows. Those take lots of data. They consume lots of energy and thereby emit lots of CO2. And we want to link or embed videos rather than repost them.
Not having a phone is almost socially unacceptable. Almost would turn you into an outcast. And I say this only because I have two teenage boys, and I can't imagine. I mean, they would murder me if I took their phones away. Or is there anything specific you say to parents who want to fight the good fight, who want to decrease their family's footprint? Is there anything specific that you would recommend to parents on how to go about trying to do that?
So just that you're asking the question, just that you're saying, okay, here's reality. I have teenagers in my life, and what is possible? That's the place to begin. I'm not interested in creating war, especially within a household. I mean, that's just not a constructive way to go about things. We can ask questions like, okay, if we can say, I've learned some things. I want to share it with you. And I'm interested in creating limits on my own use. Would you help me come up with limiting myself? So there's this great quote from Bill Torbert, who's a retired professor of management from Boston University. And he says, if you're not aware that you are part of the problem, then you can't be part of the solution. So if you announce yourself as part of the problem and then say, I need help, can you help me? Oh, wow. I think that would be fantastic to get help for you, for your problem, from your teenagers. And then they'll do what they do, but you can ask them to help you with your problem.
There's clearly no great easy solution to the question I asked you. And for a second there, I thought I was going to stump you. What a great answer. And I think that is a great starting point.
What I've found is that in all cases, none of us have a problem until we have a problem. Families with children with autism or ADD, they have an undeniable problem. And so in many cases, when they hear that protocol from the pediatrician or from the child psychiatrist with the electronic fast, they will also say, there is no way that we can go on a 3-week electronic fast. Forget it. And then Dr. Dunkley will say, okay, are you ready for another meltdown? And the parents say, no. So then they find a way to go for it. They're in an undeniable challenge. Not everyone has the privilege of an undeniable challenge. But until we get there, my job is to focus on limiting myself and recognizing my own limits within my awareness. I can also say another question that's really interesting for me. There are about 3 billion people not yet online. And I believe in universal access. Like, I recognize that in order to have educational opportunities, work opportunities, even family connections right now, people need internet access. So who am I to say that those 3 billion people should not have access? I can't go there. At the same time, I recognize that once they do get online, that exponentially increases engagement with the global super factory. It massively increases consumption of electricity, water, conflict minerals, greenhouse gas emissions. All that stuff exponentially increases. So how do we reconcile that? Do those of us who have what I would call excessive use of media, are we going to decrease our consumption by like 70 or 80%, which is what climatologists have been recommending for decades, so that other people in the world can increase their consumption a little bit? Or do we say to those people, no, you can't have it? So I think that's another cool question to introduce to family members. And we're not going to have answers, but we can have the question. Our world now has more cell phones than toilets. I have trouble with that, with saying, you can't have a toilet, but I can have more than one mobile device. But people may not even be aware that that's the dynamic going on. So we need a pretty massive campaign of real information. And the thing is that we've been giving the telecom industry billions and now trillions of dollars, and they can spread their gospel, which they do. We're going to have to be word of mouth without the trillions of dollars.
It seems to me that based on the telecommunications industry, several other industries, that on some levels, no matter how much I try to minimize my footprint or adjust my diet or, you know, be the change that I want to see in the world, that although I'd like to think I have power with that, because of everything you're saying and then some, I feel powerless. And I wonder if you feel the same way, and if you'd sort of touch on that.
I have been extremely privileged to be in conversation with a lot of phenomenal engineers and scientists and physicians for the last 15 years that, or 20 years even, that I've been researching this. And they understand the rules. The first rule is that I am a kindergartner and they have to be patient with me. So I need a lot of repetition. There are people that I call sometimes on a daily basis with my kindergarten questions. And one time I called Professor Gary Olheft. He has 2 degrees in electrical engineering. He's got a PhD in geophysics. He worked for NASA on the Apollo program starting when he was a teenager many years ago. He taught at the Colorado School of Mines for 20 years. I can tell you a lot about him. But anyway, I called him and I said, I was really mad. And I said, I need a God bigger than AT&T. And he said, try Verizon. So that made me laugh, which is good. Laughing is good. But I have really struggled with that because, as I can see, you know, in the day-to-day world, that God, AT&T and Verizon, is way, way more powerful than I am. And, you know, if you look at a child with a phone and try taking the phone away, we all recognize that we don't have very much power there. For me, it's constructive to recognize my powerlessness. I struggle all the time with the question, what's constructive use of my attention? For me, the most nourishing thing is talking with other people who are also asking that question and recognizing real limits. So if I go to my city council and I talk about this, I've done it. So far, it has not been constructive. My city council is also bound by the Telecom Act. They don't want to be sued. And if it is believed that a municipality denies a permit, say, for a cellular antenna based on health or environmental concerns, then the telecom industry can sue that municipality. I don't know any municipality that can afford a lawsuit like that. There are municipalities that are creating ordinances that say we maintain local authority over our telecom facilities. It's going to be interesting in the next year or two to see how those hold up, because the orders from the FCC, which would be a federal regulation, are saying that those ordinances have no effect. We're in appeal right now with several of these cases, and we just have to watch and see. And meanwhile, I just think spreading the word is the most important thing we can do, giving room to our anger with these regulations, giving space for them, and then coming back and saying, okay, we need to be reasonable here and ask this question, what is constructive given the limitations of what's going on?
If you can, tell us right now what the internet's main energy guzzlers are.
I see 4. The first, and they're not in any order of which is the main one, that's debatable. Access networks. That's the international array of cell towers, they're called masts in Europe, routers, that international setup that allow you to access the internet, they take enormous amounts of energy. Number two, data storage centers. This is where your websites are stored, records of all kinds, educational records, bank records, medical records, military data. Anything that goes online, your smart meter, the smart meter is the utility meter on the side of your house. And if it's a transmitting meter, it's collecting data about your electricity use and sending that sometimes thousands of times per day to a collection site that then sends it to cellular antenna, which then goes to the utility, which stores that data. Okay, in order to run data centers, which are just packed with computers, some of them are 11 million square feet large. You can see them from outer space. They need to keep cool so that those computers don't overheat. So they take a lot of air conditioning, and that requires water. You begin to see how data centers are actually, according to Greenpeace in 2012, if data centers were a country, they would rank fifth in consumption of energy. Third on the list, automated processes. Like a lot of times you'll just be at your computer and your word processor will be upgraded without your permission or anything. That's an automated process. Backup storage for websites, that's an automatic process. Bots, those now are a major energy consumer. And the last thing is embodied energy. I'm so excited to share this term with people and for all of us to start using this vocabulary. Embodied energy is the energy that goes into manufacturing every device. So in order to have any device, we need a lot of mining and refining and smelting and assembling, and all of that energy is embodied in the new device. The waste that's generated during manufacturing is embodied waste. The amount of energy that goes into manufacturing every device is way greater than the amount of energy that the device will use in its lifespan. The amount of waste generated during manufacturing is profoundly greater than what happens when we discard the item at the end of its usable life cycle. So we need this term, embodied energy, embodied waste.
So can you give us an example of embodied energy?
Okay. Let me tell a little about what goes into manufacturing silicon wafers, which are necessary for electronics and for solar panels, ironically. So you start with pure quartz gravel and pure charcoal. Typically, that'll be petroleum coke from the tar sands. Can be from other places too. And then wood chips. You need a hard, moist wood that can come from the Amazon rainforest. Those three things, quartz, the pure carbon, and the wood, will need to be transported to a smelter. So there's transportation involved, there's energy involved, and CO2 emitted. The smelter is kept at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 330 days per year. That takes an enormous amount of continuous energy. To date, only coal-fired power plants and nuclear power plants, I think you can get some geothermal power because it's continuous, but you cannot power a smelter with renewable energy because you need it 24/7, or you could blow up the factory, you could lose the silicon. So that's step one at that smelter where you will get metallurgical grade silicon. It's 98% pure. Not good enough for electronics or for solar panels. You can have one impurity part per billion for the silicon wafers in electronics. You can have one impurity part per million with solar panels. And we're finding that the purer the silicon, the more efficient the solar panel. Okay, so after we get that metallurgical grade silicon, it is then shipped to a bell jar furnace that is kept at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for the year. And again, it's a continuous process. It goes through several other processes that are also energy intensive. And whenever you hear the word energy intensive, you're going to see greenhouse gas emissions. You know, those are three steps involved in the process. And that's just one part of the energy embodied in every computer and every solar panel.
That was author and researcher Katie Singer. She was interviewed at the 2019 conference of the Hippocrates Health Institute by Ben Zeitlin. Katie Singer is a consultant with the EMR Policy Institute and presented her concerns about the Internet's footprint at the 2018 UN Forum on Science, Technology, and Innovation. In 2015, Katie Singer gave a talk at the Colorado Chautauqua in Boulder. She opened with a memorable account on how human beings, like all living beings, including plants, function by electrochemical signals. We have nearly saturated our environment with electrical and magnetic frequency fields and amplitudes that do not exist in nature. With 5G, the industry is planning to exponentially increase the exposure. Are we overpowering our innate life-giving electrochemical signals? Here is the opening of Katie Singer's talk, where she credits her mentor, Gary Allhaft.
Gary is a physicist with 2 degrees in electrical engineering. When I asked if he could edit my technical chapter, he just retired from teaching at the Colorado School of Mines. And so, he and I began a very unlikely tutorial. My first lessons from Gary Allhaft take us back a few billion years, before man-made laws or mobile phones, when this planet was a mass of gases, water, dust, and rock. After a buildup of charge, lightning began to strike. A bombardment of lightning storms led to nucleic and amino acids, the building blocks of life. Early plants made oxygen and paved the way for animals. Plants and animals still function by electrochemical signals. So do our brains and hearts. Even at rest, all cells have measurable voltage. In other words, without electromagnetic energy, none of us would be here. The ancient Greeks knew how to generate electricity, but not how to store or transmit it. The Greeks also created a regulatory system for health that included the direction to first do no harm. Humans figured out how to store electrical energy around 1750. By 1880, we also knew how to transmit it over long distances. We created batteries, motors, and electric lights, and built things like refrigerators. We transitioned from visible mechanical technologies powered by horse and human muscle, then steam and hydropower, to electromagnetic technologies whose power is invisible. By 2015, about 135 years after we began laying out an electric power grid, we have nearly saturated our environment with electrical and magnetic frequency fields and amplitudes that do not exist in nature. We have changed the Earth's electromagnetic environment more significantly than any time since humans showed up on the planet. Most of this change comes from our electric power grid and more recently from cell phones and Wi-Fi. What education prepares us to live with these massive environmental changes? What regulation protects us? I'd like to describe tonight four generations of education and regulation around electronic technologies. The first generation starts in 1925, when Gary Olheff's father, Roy, was a teenager with saved money. Roy asked his father, Gary's grandfather, Joseph, to let him buy a car. Joseph Olheft was a master car mechanic. He and Roy found a $25 Model T Ford with a problem. Joseph instructed his son to lay every part of the car on the lawn, identify the problem, and repair the car. If Roy could reassemble it and get it to drive correctly, he could have the Model T. Sure enough, Roy found the worn-out washer in the transmission. He went on to buy wrecked sports cars and fix them up for resale. Around 1930, with a crystal radio kit, Roy assembled his family's first radio. Actually, by the 1930s, we'd had intercontinental radio, then called the wireless, for several decades. We had telephones and crude televisions, refrigerators, washing machines, and military radar. In 1934, Congress established the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. "Go forth and market electronics," the FCC proclaimed to inventors, "as long as they don't create harmful interference." The FCC defined harmful interference as anything that interferes with existing licensed services, such as radio or TV broadcasts. Today, this definition, harmful interference, includes cell phone and internet services. You can't interfere with them. At the FCC, harmful interference has never included biological harm. That is, health or environmental harm caused by exposure to electromagnetic radiation, EMR, emitted by electronics. Call this exclusion of nature. Call it disregard for the regulation to first do no harm.
That was an excerpt from Aiming to First Do No Harm, The Education of Electronics Users by Katie Singer. Katie Singer was speaking at the Colorado Chautauqua in Boulder in April 2015. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio's free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.